You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House. I'm Henry Reese Sheridan. On today's show,
we've come so far, we've made so much progress, and I think this man, this president, is taking us back to another place.
It's not just to respond in anger, it's to build a political movement in this country which says that that is not who we are. We will not tolerate that type of moral inadequacy.
Reactions there from U.S. Congressman John Lewis and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders to President Donald Trump's comments referring to several African nations as shitholes last week. But Trump insists he's not a racist. Can he, or anyone else, be expected to believe it? My guests Carol Walker and Tim Marshall will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including: what does Hawaii's false alarm reveal about the risk of unintended nuclear war? A facelift for The Guardian, and dairy diplomacy. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Henry Reece Sheridan. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are political analyst Carol Walker and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com. Welcome both to the programme. Donald Trump has already denied calling African nations shithole countries during an Oval Office meeting on migration last week. Last night, he went a step further, telling press that he is in fact the least racist person they had ever interviewed as he arrived at Trump International Golf Club in Florida. Now, to be fair to Trump, the veracity of that statement does depend on the particular reporter he was addressing, but it's unlikely to be true. The New York Times put it best in an article listing Trump's history of racist comments. The president quite simply talks about and treats people differently based on their race. Carol, is it plausible that Trump sincerely thinks he's not a racist?
I think it's plausible because I think Donald Trump can convince himself of just about anything. And when he made those remarks, he probably genuinely thought, well, look, I am definitely the least racist person in the whole world, just as I'm the most wonderful president of the United States that we've ever had. But I have to say that I'm afraid on this one, I agree with the UN's human rights spokesman, Rupert Colville, who said that the only word you can use is racist if you dismiss entire countries and continents and their populations as shitholes. And the language that he used has caused huge offence. The African Union has said he should apologise. And I think when you have a president of the United States talking about an entire population, everyone coming from this country, using that kind of term, it does imply a certain frame of mind. And of course, he does have a bit of form on this. As you were mentioning, the New York Times points out, you know, talking about how the Mexicans were all criminals and drug dealers. And he's got a bit of form on this. And I think on this one, well, even Emily Thornberry, who is the shadow foreign secretary here in the UK, described him as a danger and a racist. She also incidentally described him as an asteroid of awfulness that has fallen on this world.
That's a nice one. He does have a bit of form, as you say, to put it lightly. Tim, one thing that interested me about this is that obviously, you know, Trump has come under fire for numerous instances of racially sensitive provocation, shall we put it, before. And perhaps most dramatically last year, it came in the form of his reaction to the neo-Nazi marches in Charlottesville, where he equivocated and said that, you know, there were good people and bad people on both sides. But I don't recall him having felt the need to straightforwardly deny being racist in the course of his presidency. I may be wrong on that count. What I find interesting about this is that it's in reaction to comments that he made about other countries, not his stance about something going on in America. So what explains the strength of feeling ignited by his comments?
Well, I think that he actually did deny being a racist during the campaign at once on one account. I'll come to it very briefly. There's two defences. One, he didn't say it. Now, there were seven people in the room, including not including himself. Two, including the Republican, say he did say it. Three are on the record, senators and congressmen, saying he didn't say it, and two have not. He says he didn't, so he might not. That defense doesn't stack up anyway, because it's entirely the sort of language he does use. The second defense is, that's only what a lot of people say anyway about various places. That's not a defense either, because it's not, even if it was true, which I wouldn't say it is, it's not the sort of language that you use if you're the president of the United States, even though many presidents have fallen below those standards. To come to your point about why has it gone so deep, it is because the leader of the free world, who stands for gathering in your huddled masses, is simply gazes around the world, if he did say it, and describes whole cultures, whole millions of people who gather together to form a nation, who, despite the difficulties, who, despite often being robbed by their leaders, they are still a people and a nation who feel a certain way about themselves, who have a pride in themselves. And he just dismisses it in that awful one word that is not presidential, and it's not even really human. Humane, I should say.
Carol, is the issue here that even though this was a statement that was made about foreign countries, it touched a fundamentally American nerve and a nerve which runs very deeply through the American story?
Well, I think the backdrop to this, as you mentioned Charlottesville, and he talked at the time about how both sides in this had not behaved properly. He didn't seem too upset when some far right groups expressed their support for him. I think many, many black Americans already suspected that he was racist even before he came out with these sorts of comments. So I think that is the problem, in that, as Tim says, perhaps there is the possibility that he didn't actually use this term. But I think when it feeds into this wider perception that his whole behaviour, his political stance, some of his campaign themes, this whole talk about putting up a wall, the perception of many that many black Americans already have, I think that it is a real problem. The National Association for the Advancement of Colour People has said that the president's falling deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole of racism and xenophobia. And I think when you think how important black voters are in the United States, what a huge role they play in wider society, when you have then even Americans at home thinking that they need to suspect their president's views of the world, then I think it is a serious problem. When it goes to his core vote, I suspect they will brush it aside and it won't make that the slightest bit of difference to his standing.
We've become used to it, haven't we? I mean, there isn't... It might be shocking, but it's not surprising anymore. And this is just another Trump story that will last 2 or 3 days and then go away, lingering like a bad smell in memory. I've just worked out what your question was about. Forgive me, I'm a bit slow sometimes, Henry. The deeper meaning behind the uproar in America is that America is a nation of immigrants. America is a nation built by people who came from places that often weren't very nice, to escape places that weren't very nice. You could even say that for the founding fathers, or the pilgrims in the 16th century, you know, they came from a place which was unwelcoming and hostile to them, to this land of the free. And so to simply describe all these places where people like his own descendants came from in that manner goes to the core of insulting what America is. And so, it took me a while to pick up the meaning behind your question, but I think that is one of the reasons that explains the depth of anger and, well, I was going to say shock, but we're not shocked anymore. This is Trump. Three more years.
And when he then throws in, why can't we have more people from Norway?
Yes.
That does really tend to lend weight to the idea that behind this, his thinking is that he doesn't want immigrants from poor, struggling, largely black countries.
Yeah, that is also the subject. So I've got a new book out, I'm not plugging it, in a few weeks' time. And part
available
of it is...
Available in all good bookstores. Carry on, Tim.
I'm not plugging it. But one of the themes running in the chapter about America is that underlying all this is this an anxiety in certain sections of white America that America is white. according to them. You know, that's how they define it, and they want to keep it that way as much as possible. And so when, to the core vote, when he says things like that, says things about Mexico, it actually, they say, well, yeah, you know what, we want to keep America as it is. Outside of the core vote, most white Americans would be appalled at this sort of stuff.
Carol, on the topic, and just before we move on, of Trump's core supporters, if Donald Trump is racist, and we've known that he was racist before he was president, when he was a candidate, maybe before that, is it racist to vote for him? And if so, where does that leave us in terms of our view of America more broadly?
I think that people can justifiably say that they cast their votes for various different reasons. Some people will say, well, look, I'm voting out of self-interest. I think he's going to do I think he's the best person to bring jobs to my community. They can say, I wouldn't vote for the alternative because I don't think she represents my way of life and what I stand for. I think that I would respect the right of any voters to vote for anyone for whatever reasons. If they choose to either disbelieve that he's a racist, to believe it and decide to set it aside, or indeed even to accept it, but still to vote for him for it, I think that you have to allow voters to cast their votes as they choose and to choose their own reasons for doing so.
We're going to stay in the US now, but move to Hawaii, where over the weekend, residents received a message on their cell phones warning that a ballistic missile was inbound. It ended with the words, "This is not a drill," which weren't entirely inaccurate. It wasn't a drill. Instead, an employee had clicked the wrong command during routine checks. The event was terrifying for the islanders in itself. What made it even more terrifying for the rest of us is that it came in the same week that a leaked draft policy document revealed plans to expand the number of scenarios in which the US could use nuclear weapons, as well as introducing smaller, more usable nukes. Tim, I'll begin with you.
Yep.
Has the advent of mobile technology and instant communication increased the chances of nuclear misinformation?
Yes. Well, we've just seen one. And it was the civilian side of things, of civil defence, that pressed the wrong button. That person has now been removed to other duties, we're told. It took the military side from Central Command, who measure, is there a missile coming in, to officially say, no, it isn't. And they were the ones who actually went in ahead of the civil command and reversed everything and said, no, officially there is no missile. So the two sides, the civil and the military, were not hand in hand. And also, and this is the positive side of, and there's very few positive sides of it, they discovered it's taken them 38 minutes to tell the population, oh, actually, you're not all about to die in nuclear Armageddon. I mean, that's clearly a failing, which they will now work that, God forbid it ever happens again, they can turn around 30 seconds later and say, oops, very, very loudly. Again, I also think that they've discovered the gaps in their planning. There aren't enough shelters. They looked at what happened on the highways. They looked at the level of... I don't think... Actually, people say everyone panicked. I think running through the streets isn't panicking. I think it's a very sensible idea. So I think they'll have discovered an awful lot. There's a tiny bit of me thinks that this is something to do with the upcoming tensions that are going to happen this spring with North Korea. But there's no evidence of that. And it does look like a mistake. A mistake from which lessons have been learned.
I think you can really understand the alarm that it caused. And Tim mentioned there it took them 38 minutes to discover that this was just simply a human error. Apparently, it would only take about half an hour from a missile from North Korea to actually reach Hawaii. That's
By the time it's been detected and then that thing goes off, you've got about 15 minutes from the siren.
Yeah, 15 to 12 minutes to get into shelter. And clearly you can understand why the population was so concerned. I think what this episode also shows that in this era where we are in this incredibly high-tech, finely tuned, computer-orientated world, a human error can still lead to some quite significant misunderstandings. Now, clearly in this case, it was simply a misunderstanding that led to people running to shelter when they didn't need to. But if that sort of human error can happen in those circumstances, it does highlight the risk that something could happen. If Donald Trump were, with his new nuclear strategy, to actually say, right, oh, crikey, the Hawaiians are under attack, you can really foresee how some kind of mistake like this could lead to a potentially very dangerous situation indeed. I feel very sorry for the poor guy who apparently pressed the wrong button, but it does seem extraordinary in this day and age that simply putting your finger on the wrong button could trigger an alarm like
that. And make Jim Carrey think he's about to die. Did you know he was on the
details.
This is a true story. Really? Jim Carrey was on Hawaii at the time and is one of those several hundred thousand people that was extraordinarily scared, and you have to feel bad for him.
And indeed the others as well.
Magic Johnson, yes. He was there as well.
Let's turn our attention to this leaked draft document called the Nuclear Posture Review, which is a title I find oddly pleasing. So it leaves open the possibility, among other things, of nuclear retaliation in extreme circumstances that could include a non-nuclear strategic attack. Now, one of the things that US officials are worried about is the US nuclear system's vulnerability to cyber attack. And the implication here, some experts have said, is that such an attack or a broader infrastructural attack, cyber attack on the US, could trigger a nuclear response. Tim, how much of a shift in nuclear response philosophy does this mark?
Oh, that is quite a serious shift. There's two things that they're considering shifting in their new NPR, as they call it. The first one is less controversial, I think. It's to put low-yield nuclear weapons into submarines. Now, that means you could have a tactical battlefield nuclear launch from a sub into a battlefield or against one particular designated target, not a whole city, but a central command area. Now, they already have that capacity with low-yield nuclear missiles delivered elsewhere. So all they're talking about there is shifting it into the subs as well. So that would be a shift. This is one of four or five drafts that's going around the Pentagon that was leaked. So we don't know that this is going to happen, but this is clearly what they think they might do. The second one is the more important one. Pretty much the American stance is probably almost certainly no first use. But secondly, we would only use this in a nuclear situation. You fire a nuke at us, we're going to fire a nuke at you. To now shift it to say there may be scenarios, whereas if you attack us X, Y, and Z, but not nuclear, we will still use a nuclear weapon against you. That's quite a shift. And you're right about the cyber. There's no treaty at the moment on cyber warfare. If someone takes out your entire water supply to a city, plus the electric grid, thousands and thousands of people will die. Is that an act of war? If it is an act of war, can you respond with a nuclear weapon? That's the territory they're going into.
Sorry, Cal, do you want to say something more?
Well, I think there are two worrying factors in this. Firstly, that it expands the list of scenarios whereby Donald Trump could be tempted to press the nuclear button.
His big button.
We know how volatile the American president is. We know how keen he is to prove that he's got a bigger button than the one in North Korea. We know how unpredictable he is. We know how he does have this somewhat insular view of how to put America first and a very defensive attitude towards the rest of the world. We know how unpredictable and dangerous Kim Jong-un is in North Korea. We know how belligerent the Russians can be. And we've already talked about the dangers of misunderstanding. So I think anything which expands the range of scenarios in which Donald Trump could feel justified to press the nuclear button is really, really worrying. And I just wanted to add that the second point is that you talked about this new type of weapon. It is, in fact, changing some weapons to put them on a different kind of launch scenario. But once again, it is about developing a slightly new type of weapons. We went been through a long era where all the focus was on not just reducing the tensions, but on reducing the number of weapons and warheads, multilateral disarmament. And this would seem to reverse that trend, or at least have the potential to do so.
Sorry to interrupt, Carol. There are these scenarios already in warfare where you game things out, where, okay, you signal via a missile. Okay, I'm going to attack that, but only that. And the other side knows you've only done that, and they only do something else. And it's actually limited, and they signal this to each other. I'll give you an example. The Israelis in 2006 only took out the very centres of the runways at Beirut Airport. They only bombed where the runways crossed. So after the war, you could fill us in really quickly and get back to normal. That was a signal they sent. We're not going to destroy you, but we can do. Another signal could be the Americans this year could launch a strike at a very secret place inside North Korea that the population wouldn't necessarily know about, to say to the North Koreans, we can reach you, we're not going to embarrass you. You know, these sort of things go around in military people's heads. When you've introduced, as Carol said, this new scenario, oh, we're only going to do a tactical nuclear battlefield nuclear strike on you, only a little nuke, and you might have only a little nuke back to us. Oh, come on, that's a whole new ballgame, because immediately after that, there's only one place to go, and that's full-scale nuclear warfare. So this is a good thing that we're talking about it. It is only a proposal, although it's apparently one of only four or five, so this could become US policy. I think it's February. It comes out.
You're listening to Midori House. I'm Henry Rhys-Sheridan. I'm talking to Carol Walker and Tim Marshall. We're going to come home now to the UK, where subscribers to the Guardian newspaper were greeted this morning by an unfamiliar-looking object on their doormat. The newspaper has switched to a tabloid format for the first time ever and undergone a complete graphic redesign to boot. But does this cosmetic change tell a deeper story about the state of the paper and British print journalism in general? We have copies of the old Berliner format and the new one in that... I appreciate that. Radio pros. In the studio, as we've just proved. What do you guys think, broadly? Let's begin with you, Carol.
I think it's great. I bought it this morning to have a look, to compare. It is a convenient size. It has got lots of good reading in it. I think the Guardian journalism is still up there as some of the best journalism in the UK. There are some interesting long reads. They've made a point of going for some really eye-catching pictures and photographs. There's an interesting Guardian 2 section with extra bits of, less hard news focus features to read. And I think it's a success. I think it is interesting that The Guardian is making a point of, firstly, sticking to its newspaper. The Independent, one of the other UK newspapers, is now entirely online. And it was interesting this morning to hear Catherine Viner, the editor of the paper, saying, well, look, most people do read The Guardian online these days. Most people access it through the website. There are, of course, which is more up to date. But people still like to pick up to read the newspaper. They share it. They pass it around. I'm one of those people who still does frequently buy a newspaper made of paper.
Tim, I want your opinion on it too, but I also have an extra question, which is, as Carol mentioned, this was mainly, I think quite openly, a cost-cutting exercise. What's the argument for having a newspaper at all when your circulation's at 147,000 rounding up?
Because we're in this in-between period now. And by the way, the death of newspapers was predicted a long time ago and is taking a very long time to die. And I'm like Carol, but we are of a certain age where we like physical papers. Many people who are a couple of years younger don't any longer. But let's look at the Times, for example. You can go online and take the subscription, online subscription to the Times, and they then send you coupons. So if you also want the print version, you take the coupon, you go into the news agency, hand it over, and they give you a newspaper, which is very... So you're in this interim period where they can't just suddenly stop selling 146,000 copies, but they are cutting costs. They're going to, both job-wise, but also because they now need less paper, I should say, less ink. So this is the future. I like it because if you ever use public transport, it doesn't matter if you're reading the Le Parisien or the Frankfurt Allgemeine, if you've got very long arms and you're pushing your paper into people's noses on each side of you, it's not a good look. I actually think this is a very good idea. I much prefer the tabloids. I don't think it cheapens it whatsoever. But behind your question, is there any point in having a paper? Yes, there is, as long as people like Carol and I are around, which, God willing, will be for a couple more decades yet.
So, Carol, this is probably the most significant change under Catherine Viner's leadership. She took over from her imposing predecessor, Alan Rusbridger, back in 2015. Does this redesign mark Viner taking full ownership of the paper? The previous Berliner format, which was idiosyncratic on the British newsstands, was a calling card of Rusbridge's. What effect will this have on, in terms of her ownership and the staff's perception and the public perception of this paper under her?
I think she's putting her own stamp on the newspaper. She's saying that just because we're continuing to produce this paper, newspaper, it does not mean to say that there aren't ways that we can improve it, that we can make it more, make it easier for people to read, easier for people to carry around. As Tim says, you know, if you're on the underground, it's still very nice to have a newspaper to read. On my way here, there were still plenty of people who were reading newspapers, books for that matter. And it's interesting, isn't it? You were talking to Tim about whether these things would survive. A few years back, everyone was talking about how people were soon going to stop going to the cinema because, you know, films were dead and we can all download films, we can get them things on Netflix, etc., etc. But more people are going to the cinema than ever before. And there is something about, I think, sometimes the actual ritual of these things and the way of sharing. Somehow it's easier to share a newspaper than it is something that you're looking at online on your laptop. I think Catherine Viner does want to put her own stamp on the newspaper. And I think that she sees this paper version as the showcase for everything else that The Guardian has to offer. It's interesting, too, that, you know, we talked about costs. Clearly, all newspapers and news organisations are struggling. The Guardian does not charge people to go onto its website. It doesn't have a paywall, one of the few that that doesn't. When you go online, you get a little request to donate. And apparently a lot of people do. And that helps to sustain the journalism. And I think the paper version still has a showcase role when people come to choose what they're going to look at, where they're going to consume their news. And let's face it, they've got plenty of choice these days.
Hopefully then, long live print. Finally on today's show, the EU and Mexico stand on the brink of expanding a trade deal originally signed in 2000. But a wedge, or should I say a slice issue, is stalling ratification. Spanish producers of Manchego cheese, a strong sheep's milk cheese produced in the Spanish region of La Mancha, want Mexican cheesemakers to stop using that name to sell a different type of cow's milk cheese. According to Ismael Alvarez de Toledo, president of the Spanish Brotherhood of the Manchego cheese, Manchego is the Rolex of the cheese world, the most imitated and the most abused. The Mexican version is significantly cheaper and usually stuffed into quesadillas. Mexican cheesemakers have argued that the two cheeses are so different, nobody would ever mistake one for the other. So it doesn't matter that they've got the same name. Tim, a valid point?
Yes. Blessed are the cheesemakers, is my first point. But, I mean, you just want to have fun with this story. Unfortunately, there's a serious side to it. I completely understand that champagne has to come from the Champagne region of France. Whiskey, Scots whiskey, has to come from Scotland. And so I kind of understand that Spanish Manchego, and it's also Parmesan and Gruyere and others, are all up in arms about this. So for me, it's very simple. Call it Mexican Manchego. Then you know what you're getting. You're not getting the real Manchego, you're getting the Mexican Manchego. But do you know this is the eighth round of talks they've had about this?
I didn't know that. Yes. Carol, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm just going to start by declaring an interest, which is that I absolutely love Manchego. And I'm afraid I'm
Spanish.
Totally Spanish, proper Manchego, made from 100% ewe's milk from the Manchego sheep, is absolutely my favourite cheese of all.
Whereas I like the Mexican version,
and
which is cow's milk.
Well, yeah, it just doesn't. Do you know, I don't think I've ever had the Mexican
you
version.
You have, on nachos, they melt it.
Oh, no. Sounds absolutely revolting. I don't want to go down that line. I'm with the Europeans and the Spanish on this. I think that it is right that communities take pride in some of their own specific produce. Look at how the French protect their Roquefort. Tim's mentioned the Italians and their Parmesan. We protect our English cheddar and our Cornish pasties. And I think these days, those sorts of products are prized by locals, by visitors, by tourists, and I think they enrich all of our lives. I'm with the Spanish. They should
culinary
be able to
nationalism.
Protect their Manchego
culinary
cheese
nationalism.
And send me a sample.
I agree with you.
Newspapers and culinary nationalism both endorsed on Midori House this evening. It brings us to the end of today's show. Carl Walker and Tim Marshall, thanks very much for joining me here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katy Mendoza. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next, but at 1900 hours, it's Culture with Robert Bound. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 1800 London time. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Goodbye.